I'm Dr. Daria Rose, and you're listening to The Daria Rose Show, where we bring a fact-based perspective to answer all those confounding questions that come up in our day-to-day lives. From achieving optimal health, to making conscious choices about your purchases, and raising kids that thrive, we are here to help you navigate your life with confidence. Hello, friends, and welcome back to The Daria Rose Show. Today, we have the ultimate COVID vaccine Q&A discussion with Dr. Jennifer Greer. We talk about how vaccines work, how the new COVID vaccines were developed and tested for safety, what it means that they were approved for emergency use, potential long-term risks, and what's different between the mRNA vaccines and the adenovirus vaccines. We talk about how risks are assessed for children and pregnant women, as well as how long immunity lasts and what we can expect in the future. And we try really hard to make the science as simple and understandable as possible so you can feel confident that you understand what's important when making decisions for yourself and your family. Dr. Jennifer Greer is an assistant professor of immunology at the University of South Carolina School of Medicine, Greenville. Dr. Greer earned her PhD from the University of Pennsylvania, where she studied the innate immune response to viral infections. At the School of Medicine, Dr. Greer teaches virology and immunology to the first and second year medical students, while her research lab studies immune responses in the lung during viral and bacterial respiratory infections. Super, super relevant to what we're talking about today. She lives in Greenville, South Carolina with her husband, their three cats, and a rotating cast of foster animals. It is a great discussion, and I really hope you enjoy it and learn a lot. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
I am so excited to talk to you. I have been thinking so much about vaccinations for many years now because I'm a fairly new mom. I have a three-year-old and a two-year-old, and obviously it's something that comes up a lot. And so I was sort of excited about doing a vaccine episode, or I'm going to probably do a few, but then COVID.
Yeah.
So when I started trying to figure out what to do, and I started asking my audience what they wanted to know about vaccines, I just got flooded with COVID questions. So I thought that we would just start there and see where
that leads. Sounds good.
So let's start with just the basics. So I think that in order to for everybody to follow the conversation, we just have to have sort of a baseline about what we're talking about. So can you just sort of the background of how vaccines work to induce immunity? And I know a lot of people are concerned about the COVID vaccine specifically, it's kind of new technology. Can you kind of talk about how vaccines work and how we got to this particular vaccine and just sort of the fundamentals?
Yeah, of course. So the general idea behind a vaccine is to effectively introduce your immune system in your body to a pathogen, but in a way that's not actually going to cause you any disease. So usually it's a weak form of whatever the agent might be. And when I say pathogen, I really mean anything that can cause a disease. So it might be a virus, it might be a bacteria. There's even hopes that we might have vaccines against cancer at some point in the future. So it could really be anything that could cause disease, but we obviously don't want to give you the full thing and get you sick.
Right.
So the idea with a vaccine is to just give a piece of it or a really weak version. And so it might be some of the original vaccines that were started when research started on vaccines was just to kill the original pathogen. So you could just heat it up until it died, and then you could give it to somebody, and that person would see parts of the virus or parts of the bacteria, know that it was something attacking, fight it off, and then be ready if it were to see that disease again in the future.
So when you heat up a pathogen, it breaks apart?
So it sort of dies. You can almost think of it like cooking a piece of meat.
Okay.
So it's still there. It's still present. It still kind of looks like the disease, but it's no longer living. It's not going to do any damage to the person that receives it.
Got it. And then you inject it usually?
So the most common way is we've done this as sort of injections into the muscle. And yeah, that's the sort of the common way. Most of the vaccines that we have are done that way through sort of a shot. There are studies going on to find other ways to give vaccines. And I think for a while there, we had a flu vaccine that you could sort of inhale through your nose, which was called, it was called FluMist. And I think we only had it for a couple of years just because we found that the other forms worked just better. So the shot form was great.
Got it. I think my one of my kids, or both my kids, got oral rotavirus. Is that what the one that they give orally?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. There are some oral forms as well.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And I can understand a little bit why that would be a little bit scary to just be like, here's some polio. It's fine. Just take it. So how are they tested for safety? Like, how do they know that it's dead?
Yeah. So with a full virus, so if I was going to take a full virus or full bacteria and kill it, before I could give it to anybody, I would have to confirm that it was really, really dead and not able to cause disease. And kind of backing up a little bit, I forgot to mention that not every vaccine it has the full pathogen in it. So there's actually a whole class of vaccines that include just pieces. So rather than seeing a full virus, you might just see one protein or a couple of different molecules that are important for the pathogen to survive. And so if we can target those and block those, then now we don't have the infections. But if we are worried about safety, and which we always are when we introduce any sort of new treatment or drugs, there's a whole process that any new approved drug has to go through for approval. So usually that starts with studies in animals, just to get an idea of, is it safe?
I'm curious, how many do you know? So I used to work in a molecular biology lab, and mm-hmm. there's lots of different animals. So for a vaccine trial specifically, is it mice? Is it rats? Is it higher mammals? What are the typical sort of stages that they have to go through for that safety protocol?
Yeah. So initially it usually starts with mice simply because they're well studied and they're somewhat, for lack of a better word, cheap. You can get a lot of them. You can study a lot of them. They're small. They're easy to handle. But before it would go into humans, you would go into probably rats we use occasionally. There may be some other mammals in there, but most of the time, the last step in animals before it goes into humans is monkeys of some sort. So chimpanzees, bonobos. So something as close to genetically as we can get to the human immune system and body without quite going into humans yet.
And in those animal studies, are they generally looking for acute issues, or how long do they study them? Because a lot of people are asking about long-term effects. We'll get more into that later, but I'm curious at the animal study level, like how far do they take those safety trials?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And I can't say that I know for certain, because part of the reason is these safety trials are going to differ based on which animal you're looking at. The lifespan of a mouse is much shorter than a human. So trying to do a 2 or 3 year long study.
Or a monkey.
Yeah. Trying to do 2 or 3 year study in mice is just not going to work. But in monkeys, you may do a couple of months. I think months are usually the range that we're looking at. There's also the benefit of doing this in animals is that you can sort of control the exposure. And so we don't necessarily, when we do this to humans, you give the vaccine and then you have to wait for a natural exposure to whatever we're trying to protect against. But if you're doing this in animals in the lab, you can give the vaccine, wait until they've developed the protection, which is usually 2 to 3 weeks after the second dose or whenever the last dose is. And then you are able to just give the agent and see if they're protected or not. So you can get answers actually quite quickly in animal trials that might take longer in humans.
Got it. So it sounds like the number one thing they're testing for is efficacy. And obviously, if there was some super acute issue, they would see that as well.
Yeah, well, and they would see safety as well. So they're not necessarily going to end the trial as soon as they do the exposure. They would follow these animals out for probably, like I said, about 2 months, I think, is the general range. And so you will get that kind of idea of, oh, a week or two later, how are they doing? And maybe a month later, how are they still doing? And kind of, so we'll see the hypercute for sure if there's going to be anything that goes wrong. But then you'll also see some of that, like things that might happen shortly after the vaccine, if there was going to be any safety concerns.
And what kind of things are those? Like, what are they looking for specifically?
Yeah, so the biggest thing that we're always looking for is allergic reactions, because those can be really severe if somebody has an allergic response to the vaccine. Beyond that, they can be highly variable, and often it's dependent on the disease that you're researching. So for example, I think one of the things that we sometimes will see is if the disease causes a particular complication, we want to make sure that the vaccine doesn't cause that as well, whether it's some type of hyperinflammation or some sort of damage to a particular tissue. You just want to make sure that whatever piece of the virus or the pathogen or the milder version that you're giving isn't able to cause similar symptoms.
I see. So kind of like what we're seeing with the COVID vaccine, I know that COVID has been associated with blood clots in certain people, and we're seeing at least some families of the vaccines that have been developed do seem to be resulting in some blood clots. And so that's mm-hmm. the type of thing you would be looking for. And it is the sort of thing that would come up fairly soon.
Yeah, you would expect to see that. I think historically, if we've seen complications from vaccines, they really have happened in the 2-month window after vaccination. So that's all the more reason why we're studying people at least 2 months out after vaccines before we're even considering approval.
Got it. So that was my next question, is how long are the humans followed after, in the early trials, how long are they followed after being given a vaccine?
Yeah, so after obviously we do the animal trials and it looks safe and effective in the animal trials, then it'll go into humans. And really the first trial is just a safety trial. They're not even trying for whether it's going to work or not to prevent this, but just, is it safe to give to people? And so they're really going to wait, the researchers doing these experiments are going to wait sometimes 2 to 3 months to see what the initial response is. But then that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to stop studying. So the people mm-hmm. that got the vaccine in the very first phase 1 clinical trials, which I think we're now coming up on almost a year ago, they are still being studied. So we're still collecting data from them. So if we were going to see something long-term, we're not going to miss it. We're still collecting that data.
And does that continue like indefinitely? So for example, vaccines that were developed 30 years ago, are the first kids that were in those trials still, like, if they get cancer or something horrible, like, you know, and there starts to be something, would that be seen at this point?
So we're not following quite that far out. The COVID trials, I believe, are their first initial kind of study termination will be after 2 years. So 2 years from the receipt, from getting the vaccine, I think from the first dose for the ones that have 2 doses. So they should have quite a lot of information. And within that 2 years, I think we'll have the understanding of, do we need to continue following these people further out? Or have we kind of passed the window of, we don't expect more complications to potentially appear?
Okay.
And again, historically, we really haven't seen any vaccine complications showing up past 2 months. So going out to 2 years is already well past what we would need based on the data that we have so far.
Really? So there's never been any complications that's gone out past 2 months?
So I think some of the complications you've seen might be 6 weeks, but really that it seems to be quite soon after the vaccine and not something that we see far in the distance.
For all vaccines?
Yes. Okay. Yep. Across the board.
How then is this process changed? Because I know with the COVID vaccine, we have done the emergency authorization. So mm-hmm. which parts were skipped?
None of them, actually.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So just to highlight kind of what happened, I think we were talking about the vaccines, and there's a couple of things that have happened since we first started with vaccines to get us to where we are now that I think have been really, really important, is that all this time, we've been studying the vaccines that we've created to find better ways to make them faster and more efficient. And we're studying the pathogens too, so that we understand which proteins or which pieces of the pathogen we can use in the vaccine that's going to be the safest and the most effective potentially. And so these vaccines were done using information that we already had from SARS coronavirus 1. So back in the early 2000s, we had that outbreak of SARS-1. That was obviously a really concerning disease. And so there was a lot of study on that. And people found which proteins were most important for the virus to infect. And they were able to sort of start understanding the biology of the virus. So that when SARS-CoV-2 appeared, and this is the virus that causes COVID, we already had a ton of information from SARS-CoV-1. So it wasn't starting at a blank slate. We could take what we already knew about COVID-1 and just apply it and update it for our new information. So it saved us a lot of time. So we were able to get to an authorized vaccine much quicker.
My God, we are so lucky.
Yes.
We are absolutely so lucky because, I mean, first of all, SARS-1 was so much worse. I mean, it was so much more deadly. Yes. And we're so lucky that we were not only able to contain that before it really did as much of an infection as as COVID, but also that we were able to learn so much to kind of get a hold. I mean, obviously this one is still a disaster, but at least we now have vaccines. And I went on vacation last week and haven't been like locked in my house. You know, like that part's kind of ending. So that's amazing. The dosage. So how, like during the trials, how do they give different doses and figure out the most effective one? Do they start that process in animals and then sort of guess about humans based on body weight, or how does that go?
Yeah, so both. They do in animals, they will try different doses and then they'll scale those up to humans based on body weight. So we can figure what dose per, you know, kilogram or gram based on the animal, and then you can scale it up to a human. But then they will try a couple of different doses because as good as the animal models are, they're obviously not the same as a full human being. So they do try a couple of different doses. So if I remember correctly, Moderna tried 2 or 3 different doses and found at their highest dose, they had good immune responses, but the side effects were much stronger. Mm. And then on the lower end, you got a reasonably good immune response, slightly less side effects. And so I think they actually ended up kind of in the middle with their middle dose, where they have some side effects, but they're manageable. But you do get a really strong immune response that then hopefully at the time they were hoping would translate into protection.
So back to the emergency authorization then. So if they didn't skip any steps, why doesn't it just get the full approval right away?
So it's partially because we don't have, or at the time that they were applying, we didn't have real world data. So we didn't know how the vaccine would work in people living their day-to-day lives. So what instead they started out with was the data from their phase 3 trials, which was really thousands of people, 20, 30,000 people across these trials that got the vaccines. And they followed them for, I think, at least 2 months. And some of these patients, they had data for further out. And then they are able to apply. And what the decision is coming from the fact that this is a disease that's causing death. So there's definitely advantage to getting this out sooner rather than later. So the thought with the FDA emergency use authorization is if we get this vaccine out, we can start saving people's lives now while we finish collecting this data, get more information, get more sort of examples of how it works in the real world. Because you can imagine that people that are part of this vaccine are probably people that are behaving very carefully. So they're probably,
you know, people wearing, in the trial?
Yeah, in the trial, sorry. In those initial trials, they knew the seriousness of the infections. And so they were probably the people that were masking and distancing and staying home as much as possible. Whereas, you know, once you get it into a larger population, there's so many more variables and behaviors and activities. And so you don't always know if that initial trial is going to look the same as it is in the full population.
Yeah, it's also a numbers game, right? Because it sounds like
absolutely
the blood clots are really like really few, and you might, that's the sort of thing that you might not catch in a trial of 30,000 people because it only happens in like 1 in 10 million people or whatever the numbers are there.
Yes, exactly.
Crazy. Okay. So the FDA decided to get it out, but I presumably they're going to go through this process, right? Is it that the FDA process is slow and because of like bureaucracy? Is that, so the science wasn't compromised, but
correct.
The bureaucracy part is what takes forever and that they decided to skip?
Yes and no. So there is definitely, so the safety requirements for authorization are exactly the same between emergency use and full use. So there's no shortcuts on the safety side. It's just a matter of how much data you have to collect. So it's sort of saying like, how confident are we in this data? And so at the point of the emergency use authorization, they did have, like I said, it was like 30,000 patients. And that's enough for reasonable confidence, but it's not full confidence. And so the difference is just how much data did you have?
I see. And so, for example, if there weren't a pandemic and this was just a disease that happened if you traveled to the tropics, then it would go through the normal process. And then how many people would they have had to do the trial on, like 50,000, 100,000?
So they probably would have done, they probably would have done more people, and it would have just been over a longer time period as well. For better or worse, since COVID was spreading so quickly at the time that they were doing the trials, they actually had a fair number of people get infected quickly in the placebo group. So you could
see, yeah.
You had that comparison.
I see. The issue could be that if people are being super careful and they're now vaccinated, then you might not see any cases for a long time. And then it would take you a long time to get a proper number to say this is 80% effective or whatever. But because there was a lot of COVID, then a lot of people did actually get breakthrough infections or whatever. And it was enough to give them numbers that they could use then to say this is our effective rate.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Got it. Sorry, that took me a second. Okay, cool. So it sounds like on that front, it's going pretty well. Can you talk a little bit about mRNA vaccines? Because I know there's some concern about those being on the newer side. And I think people get a little scared by new science words. When I think of mRNA, I have decades of history in my brain that makes me be like, oh, that's going to be clearly better. Like to me, that sounds clearly better. But I'd love for you to explain kind of the different types of vaccines and how we can feel about an mRNA vaccine.
Yeah. So I'm actually really excited to talk about this because some of the work, the research that I've done in my past was looking at immune responses to RNA. So this is actually, I was so excited when I heard that there was mRNA vaccines in the process. So really the idea behind the mRNA vaccine is that rather than giving a piece of the virus or a protein or a dead virus, we're really kind of giving instructions to the body on how to make that piece of the virus. And so it's turning the cells of the person that gets the vaccine into a factory to make these proteins just for a short amount of time.
And that's what the virus does too, right?
Right. A virus infection is going to make just as much, if not significantly more.
Right. Because it's protein. So if a virus infects a cell, it's going to inject its own genetic code and your cell, your own cell machinery is going to start copying, it's going to use your cell machinery to make copies of itself and like spread out. So it's going to be every single protein that is needed to repackage the virus, right? And so in this case, they're putting in a part of the code, but just a tiny part of it, right?
Yeah. So most of the vaccines for COVID are based on just one protein, and that's the spike protein. And it's a protein that's sort of on the surface. So it's not even something that could have a function inside your cells that might do some damage. It's just, it shows up on the surface of the cells. So yeah, so we can give this piece of mRNA, it goes into the cell, the cell's own machinery starts to kind of copy it and make new versions of it and really turn it into proteins. So it's really making copies of the protein, not making copies of the mRNA. And it puts those on the surface. And that is going to be sort of the symbol or the signal to the immune system that, hey, something's here that isn't supposed to be here. And that's going to trigger the immune response to start and respond. And the nice thing about mRNA, doing this with mRNA, is one, it's really easy to make. So one of the questions you asked earlier is, if you're giving a dead version of a virus, how do you know it's dead? If I'm giving a piece of mRNA, it was never alive in the first place. So I don't have to worry about making sure that it's dead and can't infect or can't do more damage. It's literally just a piece of molecules. And so that means that they're usually kind of, there's less safety, not safety precautions, but there's less concerns about the safety with this.
Right. Because it's not the entire virus, it's going to have less of the parts that are dangerous.
Yeah, exactly. And it doesn't even have any of those parts. In fact, all it has is, I think of it almost like I said, it's almost like instructions for how to make it. So the instructions for something that could do damage, the instructions themselves are not particularly damaging.
Although it does seem like there might be some, the spike protein seems really sticky, right?
Yeah, it does. We're definitely learning more about this spike protein as we learn more about this virus in general.
So the real risk is going to be if the spike protein itself does something wonky. And it seems like it maybe in a few people, it makes them maybe it makes some clotting things happen. But for the most part, you're just giving instructions. And then, so the injection is in your shoulder muscle. Mm-hmm. And so the cells that then take up the mRNA are going to be muscle cells that are presenting the spike protein. And that's why your arm gets sore.
Sore.
Got it. Does it move around? Like once it's in your arm, does it move around your body?
So it can a little bit. So those nanoparticles or the nanolipids that are used to kind of help get the mRNA into the cells, it is possible that those could kind of travel a little bit, right? They're kind of in the space between cells when you first inject it. But then as they come in contact with cells, they are sort of going to almost think of like if you ever put oil in water, you might have some oil bubbles that float around on the surface. But when they contact each other, sometimes they'll merge. Mm. And so what's really happening is those lipids are kind of floating around. And as they come in contact with the cells, they'll kind of merge and just release that mRNA that's inside into the cytoplasm of the cell. So a single nanolipid might float around for a little bit longer and not merge right away. It might make it a little bit further, but eventually it's going to come in contact with that membrane and it's going to stop.
And so then all the immunity comes from those muscle cells presenting the spike protein?
So that is definitely a big part of it. There's definitely a lot more than kind of like how the immune system talks to itself and responds. And some cells will take pieces of it and travel to your lymph nodes. But really, it starts with the expression of the mRNA in those muscle cells.
Kind of amazing that that works.
Yeah, it's really amazing. And the added benefit of mRNA is that the mRNA of the vaccine stays in the cytoplasm. So there's no change to the cellular DNA. So you don't have to worry about long-term changes to somebody's muscle cells. And then mRNA itself is somewhat unstable, which has turned into some concerns with having to keep all the vaccines super cold, so for transport. But it also means that once you put it in, it's going to start to degrade relatively quickly. So it's not like you were going to have this mRNA sticking around for years so that you're always making spike protein. And in fact, after a couple of days, it seems like you stop making it. And that's still enough for an immune response.
Yeah. So mRNA doesn't get at all incorporated into DNA, right? Because that is they're not compatible. And there are generally mRNAs. So mRNAs are like these little bits of genetics that sort of code for a specific protein. And mm-hmm. Your cells are making proteins all the time. So there's like tons of RNA like floating around in your cell. So it has a disposal process for those.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have tons of mRNA and they can get degraded by enzymes or sometimes they're kind of unstable and they fall apart on their own. Yeah.
This is still pretty new technology though, right? That like in terms of using it as a human vaccine.
So relatively new, although the studies have been kind of ongoing for these mRNA vaccines for a couple of years. And so I think Moderna actually has some studies to do mRNA vaccines with Zika virus. So if you remember Zika virus from a couple of years ago.
I was pregnant. I was terrified.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. So this is something that they've been studying for a while. And that's another reason why we were able to get a vaccine to market so quickly is they had already kind of worked out all the kinks in the process of making an mRNA vaccine. And then all they had to do was change from whatever protein in Zika they were studying to now the spike protein in COVID. And that's a pretty fast change. You can just do that. And as soon as you have the sequence, you're pretty much ready to start making that mRNA.
So I can imagine that we're about to be flooded by mRNA vaccines.
Yes.
Because this has gone really well.
Yeah, I believe Moderna is already working on two or three more other vaccines against other viruses that are based on mRNA.
So you mentioned the nanolipids. And yeah, I liked your analogy of sort of oil on water. So, right. So cell membranes are made out of fats. Lipid is another word for fat. And basically, in order to get two fat bubbles to merge, or if you want anything to go into the fat bubble that's your cell, you need it to be another fat bubble. So you put the mRNA inside of the little fat bubble and it merges with the other one and then it's inside your cell, which is where we want it. So I'm curious, that sounds all great, but I'm sure there's other like stabilizers and other things that need to be in there. Do we know actually what's inside do we know all the ingredients in the COVID vaccines?
For most of them, yes. Okay. So you can go online and if you just Google COVID vaccine ingredients and find a reputable source. So I believe the CDC has some information out there and you can find the full list what's in there. The only thing you may not find the exact molecule name for is the lipids themselves, because the companies have kind of made their own version of the lipid, and that's where they're
proprietary.
It's proprietary. That's where they're going to make their money. But everything else that's in there, you can find. And so a lot of the things that are in there are pretty much salts and sugars that are just stabilizing the nanolipids. And salts and sugars that's in our diet, that's in the bloodstream already.
Well, that's why it stabilizes it, right? Because that's what a cell sits in.
Exactly. So those, I wouldn't expect those to be causing you much of an issue, because those are things that are already present in significant quantities in our bodies already.
So there's no mercury or arsenic or anything fun like that in there?
No, not at all.
When I was asking people about this, the biggest question I got over and over again was concerns that it was developed too fast and that we don't know what's going to happen in 10 years. And so, I mean, based on everything you just said, which is squares with everything I've already heard about from immunology in my training, which was not nearly as extensive as yours, I'm wondering where these fears are coming from. I mean, the quickness totally makes sense. I mean, most people don't know what you just described about how we had SARS-1 and that that was such a scary disease. And a lot of scientists just like went to town trying to figure that out in case it ever got out again. And also it makes total sense that the mRNA vaccine had been in the works and that we just sort of ported this idea into that package, which turned out to be fantastic. But, you know, I don't. Yeah. So that part to me makes sense. The part that is harder to grok is the long-term effects that we don't have any data for.
Right. So this is hard because there's always the possibility. As a scientist, I hate to say there's no chance, right? Because there's always new information that we might get that might say that, oh, there is this one potential. But historically, we have a lot of vaccines that are already available, and we just don't see long-term effects with vaccines. We don't see long-term side effects. Obviously, we have long-term effects because they're effective for years. But we aren't seeing 10 years after the measles vaccine, we're having some change. We're not seeing it with any of the tetanus or pertussis or any of these other vaccines. So there doesn't seem to be a historical grounds for these concerns. That doesn't mean they aren't valid concerns, absolutely. But if anything, going from, say, a killed virus or a protein piece in a vaccine back to mRNA, the mRNA itself is almost safer and even more inert than those killed versions or some of those modified, weakened versions. And so we've kind of taken a step to the safer side. And so I'm pretty confident saying that we are unlikely to see long-term effects. And alternately, I mean, there might be something about COVID, right? There may be something. We mentioned the spike protein is sticky and weird, and it seems to be doing something. And I think about if we didn't have this vaccine, then chances are we'd all probably get COVID at some point, and we're all going to get exposed to that spike protein. But we're going to see it in the context of the virus, which has all of the other nasty pieces of the virus happening, plus that risk for like the severe COVID where people are in the hospitals and on ventilators. So I can't say that there will never be any long-term risk from this vaccine. But I think for me, the risk of the infection is so much worse and highly, if I wasn't vaccinated, that's my future. So the vaccine, it's sort of that risk may be unavoidable if it even exists. But I do think it's unlikely with the vaccines.
But the other thing with COVID too is that a lot of people are like, but I'm young and healthy. And you just said maybe something in the future, maybe. So, but a lot of people that are young and healthy get COVID and they're fine. And or at least, you know, their symptoms are fairly mild and they recover and they feel that is a known risk, I think. And so that was another question that got a lot was, I'm young and healthy, why bother? Why not wait 2 years and see if something does come up with this vaccine that might be worse for me than a brief bout with COVID at the age of 30?
Yeah, so I guess one thing that I that's always in the back of my mind is we don't really know what the long-term effects of infection are either, right? So we don't know if 10 years down the line, we're going to find some sort of long-term issue in people that did have COVID, even if they had a mild infection.
And in fact, we've seen some of that. That's what's scary to me. That's why I'm very likely to be an asymptomatic person. I'm like so healthy and I never get sick. But I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to get problems down the road from this disease, which seems to like have like effects in the brain, effects in the heart, effects in the lungs. Like,
Right. So to me, I think risking COVID, even if you feel like it's probably not going to be a bad infection for you, is kind of a gamble. Because we don't know what that long-term effect is going to be. And then you hear these stories of someone in their 20s and 30s that was healthy and active, and they do get a severe infection and pass away.
And kids have died from COVID. People act like kids are immune to it, which is absolutely false.
It's like
kids have died. Five-year-olds have died. It's tragic.
Yeah. So the risks are still there. And so we're not seeing the vaccine causing anything near the level of fatalities or side effects or these complications that the infection is.
Right.
So, and like I said, if the vaccine's causing a long-term effect, it's probably going to be something very similar to what we see with the full infection. And so you're choosing if that long-term effect is going to exist. Do I want to take that risk with a vaccine, or do I want to take it with a risk with the full infection? And I think the full infection scares me a little bit.
Yeah, me too. Right. It really scares me a lot. And that's why I'm still super cautious around my kids. I don't let them go anywhere still without full hazmat suits. But that's a joke. But yeah, I'm very, very protective around my children because I'm nervous about all that. So one thing also that comes up sometimes when Because I spent a couple weeks before prepping for this interview kind of in anti-vax. And one of the things that people seem to be concerned about, and I listened to a really long podcast about it that didn't quite make sense to me, but there was some people seem to think that vaccines in particular, maybe not even specifically COVID, but vaccines in general can create like long-term autoimmune issues. And do you know the basis of this? Because I listened to the podcast, I have scientific training, and I was like, so the B cells and the what, and they reduce your natural immunity versus your adaptive immunity. Have you heard this stuff?
I haven't heard the details, but I did, when you asked sort of me to do this podcast, I kind of did a similar thing where I kind of looked to see what are the myths and the information that's out there. And so I know that there's at least been one or two sort of like viral videos that made those claims. And there has been, historically, there is some potential side effects. The biggest one called Guillain-Barré syndrome, which we saw with, I think it was a previous iteration of a flu vaccine. But that's, for the record, Guillain-Barré can happen with vaccines, but it can also happen with virus infections, and it can happen with some common types of drugs. So that wasn't something that's specific for vaccines, and it's really rare.
Mm-hmm. Do you mean like recreational drugs or prescription drugs?
Prescription drugs. Okay. Yeah. So it's something that in the hospitals they keep an eye out for, but it is pretty rare. And so that might have been kind of the original source is back when this first flu vaccine, and I think looking at my notes, is it was in the 70s. So this isn't anything recent, no recent vaccines. But, you know, so it is sort of like the body's reacting inappropriately to some sort of immune challenge, whether vaccine or virus or drug. So I think it's worth considering and looking into, because I think we'd be remiss if we just said, oh, no, we don't need to worry.
Right.
Right? That's not really going to instill confidence in anyone.
Right, right.
But in looking at specifically, especially the mRNA vaccines, autoimmunity really means immune response against yourself. And so the mRNA vaccines that we're giving, it looks very similar to the self. So there isn't anything in there that says, hey, we need to destroy this. Each cell makes millions of copies of mRNA every day, and that's survivable, and it doesn't induce autoimmunity. And so I think it's unlikely with this. And the fact is now that we've been following patients that received the first clinical trial doses over a year ago, and now millions of people since. And we're really not seeing these autoimmune flares-ups or dysfunctions or anything like that.
Yeah, and it's hard to imagine why that would come very much later.
Right. Usually if you're going to get an immune response to something, it's happening within the first week or two.
Right. You're not looking at something 10 years out or 20 years out. Let's talk a little bit about the adenovirus vaccines too, because so it's Pfizer and Moderna that are the mRNA vaccines, but the AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson are based on a different technology. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah. So they're based on adenoviruses. And what that is an adenovirus is really, for most of us, a common cold. We've probably been infected with multiple adenoviruses in our lives. And so what AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson did, and I think the Sinopharm, there's a couple of other vaccines built around this same idea, but they took that piece of the spike protein from the SARS coronavirus 2 and put it into an otherwise mostly harmless virus. But then to be extra safe, they also killed it too, or they made it replication incompetent. So it can get in, but it's never going to make more copies. And so it's kind of just, again, in this case, the adenovirus is a delivery vehicle. It's just kind of like an envelope for a message, with the message being the spike protein.
So those ones have been not as effective in a couple ways. One, they don't seem to have quite the robust immune response that we're seeing from the mRNA, so especially against some of the variants. So that was something that was kind of a bummer, I thought, because I would have loved for the Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca vaccines to be crushing the Brazilian variant and the South African variant. But it seems that if you live in those areas, you really want to get one of the mRNA vaccines. But then the other issue is that those were the two that were starting to be linked to very, 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 very rare blood clots. And I don't think we quite understand why, no?
Yeah, no, I actually looked into that because I thought, well, this is something we definitely want to talk about. And it's not really clear why. And so the first thought was maybe it's the spike protein, right? Because we see clotting in the virus. We see clotting in just a few, very few people after these vaccines. But we're not really seeing this after the mRNA vaccines. So that makes me think that it's probably more about the adenovirus vector that we might want to study that a little bit more. And actually, as I looked into the processes, we're still not quite certain what causes the clotting after COVID. I think there's a lot of research happening, and so we may know quite soon. But it seems like after the vaccines, it's kind of related to potentially some of the, and now I can't remember the word, just sort of like platelets and there's one particular factor, which I can't remember the name of now. So they have found the sort of the involved piece for the vaccine-related clotting. And it seems to be actually kind of different than what we're seeing in the COVID-related clotting.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So it could be that there's an overlap and we just haven't found it. But the thought is, I'm not really certain why it's happening in the adenovirus vaccines. But for COVID, it seems to be that it might be something to do with the repair pathways and the inflammation that's happening, especially because the infections with COVID are just widespread. It's throughout the body. Lots of damage is happening, and that's kind of a repair thing. And so they think COVID, it's about repair. But we're not really, with the adenovirus, there's a particular factor that's involved that seemed to be connected. So maybe they're both part of the same pathway. I'm definitely not like a blood biologist. I'm not all up on my clotting factors. But it seems like there may be actually kind of different ways that it's happening. And so that makes me feel a little bit better that we could get COVID-specific vaccines that aren't going to have this clotting side effects. And again, kind of thinking about, we're not seeing this in the mRNA vaccines. So it seems like we could find a way to get around this. And just kind of a fun fact, I looked up based on like how rare the side effects are, that clotting. And then I looked at risks of like some other things that might happen. And someone is 3 times more likely to be killed by lightning than to have a blood clot after the adenovirus vaccine. So
that's good.
Just to put that in context.
Yeah. That's, I like that. That helps. Actually, I'm suddenly curious. I know that there was some, I saw some early reports that, speaking of blood, that blood type actually matters for COVID risk. And I was also wondering, do we have any idea of who is getting these clots? Is it something kind of like if I'm a pregnant woman on birth control, does that make me more likely? Because I know that makes me more susceptible to clots, but does that necessarily mean that I should be more afraid of getting a COVID vaccine? And then also, how does that interact with my blood type? That's all very interesting.
Yeah. I actually have no answers for that. So I also saw the stories that said that there's a tie to blood type. And I don't remember the blood type that makes you more susceptible, but I do know I'm type O, and that was one of the less susceptible types.
Yeah, I think
types.
It was so A.
I think so. But I just remember beating it and like kind of wiping my brow and be like, whew, okay, type O, I'm all right. So, but yeah, it sounds like there was some connection to blood type, but I really don't know how all of that ties in. And I don't know that we have enough data on people with blood clots after the vaccines to even kind of figure out the risks, if that makes sense. Like it's been so few cases, right, that we don't know what makes them unique.
You don't have the statistical power to figure out anything.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Oh, did they all go out to dinner the night before? Okay, maybe that's important. Maybe it's not. Something we just don't have enough information.
They definitely did not go out to dinner.
Yeah, probably not.
They have not been anywhere. All right. Let's see. Well, and that's an example, like the blood clots, I feel like are a great example of the type of side effect you can catch within 2 months.
Yeah. Well, and you know, a great thing for better or worse is that as soon as it was recognized by the scientific community, it was taken really seriously, mm-hmm. right? Though there was a pause on the Johnson & Johnson, people were studying this really extensively. And so it kind of also speaks to that question of like, did we cut any corners? Do we have to worry about vaccine safety here? And the answer is, I don't, there's no corners cut because they are really, really being careful about what's being given to the public. And so the fact is, we could have seen these really rare complications and said, they're rare, we're not going to worry about it. But they stopped those trials. They stopped those giving the vaccines and studied it, made sure that it was extremely rare or figuring out that it's not going to be happening wide scale, and then said, okay, now that we have more information, it's safe enough to continue. And so I think it just says to how serious researchers are taking the potential for complications.
Absolutely. And I'm curious, do you happen to know what they did when they paused?
I don't know for sure. My guess is that they honed in on those specific patients and then, like we mentioned, just tried to find things in common to see if there was a particular risk. So if they did study and every patient had some particular disease, or if, you know, if you mentioned all of them were on birth control or something, then they might change the recommendations and change the right, who can get which vaccines.
But they found no pattern.
Right. They didn't find any particular pattern that they were concerned about or that they could predict. So they did continue on. Although I have read that I think they are now encouraging pregnant women to get the mRNA vaccine if they are able, just to avoid, because pregnant women are right at higher risk for blood clots. And then you add in this potential risk, although small, with the vaccines. And so the idea is, you know what, just.
Yeah. And also you're risking two lives, not one.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So don't add that extra risk from the vaccine. If you can, just get the mRNA and you don't have to worry.
So as a mom, and I know that I am not alone on this. People want their kids to be back in school and they want their kids not to get COVID, and they want their kids definitely to not die of COVID. And ideally they would get to have birthday cakes at school again and stop wearing masks and all that. So yeah. as they're doing these trials and they're considering vaccines for the children, I'm curious like how that's different. So that was another question I got a lot. Like, kids are low risk. Why would I risk my kids? But, you know, when I think about vaccines, I mainly think about kids and they tend to tolerate vaccines quite well. But I'm curious sort of what the process is for the development and what should parents be concerned about?
Yeah. So if we're talking about a vaccine that's going to be used in children, often it goes through the whole process of safety in adults first. And part of that is just because we, you know, adults are kind of done developing and we know a fair bit about what's going on. But the other piece to that is children are considered a vulnerable population. A lot of children may not have the knowledge or the sort of the expertise or the even sort of the emotional capacity to make an informed decision. So when deciding on what could be an eligible vaccine for children, there's a lot of considerations into reducing the risks as much as possible so that whatever we're giving to them is safe. They don't have to be so concerned about what is going to be the side effects to me or the potential for long-term risk. So the safety process is really, really rigorous for children. So as I said, getting that FDA authorization usually requires going through the whole process of approval for an adult vaccine and then restarting the whole process with even more rigorous safety standards to be able to give it to children. And the biggest one we mentioned earlier is dosing. You can imagine a dose for an adult human might look very different than an adult or a dose for a small child. So we start with the dosing and we start with what we know is a safe dose already. And then they'll kind of figure out, okay, we're changing the weight by what percent, so we might need to scale this down. And so they did that with all of these COVID vaccines. They tried, again, they kind of jumped all the way back to the phase one trials and then phase two. And then now they're kind of getting into phase three. So it's almost like you have to go through the whole safety process twice before you
even more, right? Because they're doing age batches, I feel like.
Yeah, I mean, it is really, really rigorous. And that's part of the reason why it just takes longer to get it into children because you do have all of these additional considerations.
And I'm curious, you mentioned earlier that one of the most common actual negative effects of vaccines is allergies. And mm-hmm. do you know what it is typically that people are allergic to in vaccines?
So a big one is eggs. It is, for a fair number of vaccines, the if we're using a killed virus or a modified virus, they're often grown in eggs because eggs are sort of just like a soup of proteins,
right,
without having to worry about lots of different cells. And so if someone does have an egg allergy, that's would be a concern for potential allergy to getting vaccines. That is not the case for at least the mRNA vaccines. Mm-hmm. I'm not as clear on the adenoviruses or how those are prepared, if they do passage them through eggs or not.
That's interesting. My daughter is allergic to eggs and has had no trouble with vaccines at all.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Different people have different levels of severity of their allergies. So it may not even be a concern for everyone that has an egg allergy.
Yeah. They're hoping she's going to grow out of it. I'm hoping she's going to grow out of it because we want pancakes.
Yeah.
Did you say they are testing it on pregnant women? Or they, I think that they just allowed pregnant women to do it if they wanted, correct? Or are
yes.
they doing specific trials on pregnant women?
I believe both, actually. Okay. Yeah. So I think they are there's definitely studies happening on pregnant women because for sure we want to study that population. But in the meantime, there are groups that are collecting data on women that have already been vaccinated, who were either pregnant when they got vaccinated or got pregnant sort of during that vaccine course. So if you had the two shot, if you got pregnant in between the two shots. And I know it was even reported in some of these early, like the giant phase three clinical trials, that there were patients that got pregnant during the trial. Mm. So we have data from those patients as well.
I recall when I was pregnant, you do get vaccines, right? I think I had to get mm-hmm. tetanus or what's it, pertussis or that one.
Yeah. There's
the Tdap. Yeah. Oh gosh, that one hurts. And if I remember correctly, you do that so that your child has that immunity.
Correct.
Right. Mm-hmm. So in theory, if a pregnant woman got a COVID vaccine, her baby may be protected.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I have seen some studies now where people are kind of studying the transfer of those COVID vaccine antibodies from mother to child, and they're starting to see that. So it does look really, really promising for protecting newborn infants.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I also remember when I was, pregnant and reading about nursing and all that mm-hmm. one of the benefits of nursing is that you impart some of your immunity to the baby through breast milk as well. And I'm curious
yes.
if a nursing mother gets a vaccine. I haven't seen any data yet, but I'm curious if you would think that it would be beneficial as well.
Yeah, I think actually that data is out. Oh. So we definitely do see the antibodies in breast milk. Yeah, we actually saw that before we saw sort of the antibodies transferred after birth, simply because it's a lot easier to get samples of breast milk than it is to track down of one of the few women that got vaccinated while pregnant and then follow them out to after birth. But yeah, and in both cases, whether it's from mother to child while they're pregnant or while breastfeeding, we are seeing transfer of antibodies.
This is so fascinating. I wonder if we could all just make some breast milk like cheese or ice cream, and maybe people wouldn't have to get vaccines. They could just have an ice cream cone.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, the unfortunate thing is that if you're ingesting it, it doesn't stick around for very long. So we would have to, we'd constantly be having
constant
to eat ice cream.
Ice cream. Yeah. I think we just solved our problem here. Oh, and then do we know yet how, so I know this has been an evolving story. And so we know for sure that the COVID vaccine has a pretty effective against getting COVID, getting severe COVID. But do we know if it protects against transmission or infection in general?
Yeah. So these studies are pretty much coming out right now.
Yeah.
So we're seeing the mRNA vaccines seem to be really effective. So the original studies that came out said that they were over 90% effective at blocking the disease form, so like symptoms and stuff. But we're now seeing that they've looked at people that got these vaccines and they're testing them regularly. And it seems that the vaccines are blocking over 90% of infections as well. So I like 80% of infections, 90% of disease. So, and
that's astoundingly high.
That's huge. And some of these studies included areas that had the variants already circulating.
Oh, wow.
So we're seeing protection against the variants from the mRNA vaccines as well. The adenoviruses are still pretty good. They're not quite as good as the mRNA vaccine. So they're more in the range of like 50 to 70% protection against infection. And then it drops a little bit depending on which variant might be in the area. But in all cases, we're seeing pretty good decreases in the risk of infection. And then going along with that, if we're having fewer infections, that means fewer chances for transmission. So less likely to spread it to people that someone might come in contact with.
So, I mean, I just can't imagine a better case scenario.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just astounding.
I completely caught me as a virologist and as an immunologist, I was completely caught off guard by how successful these were and
so
kind
fast.
Of on the first try.
Yeah.
Right?
Wow.
One and done. Yeah. It was great.
It's incredible. So, and speaking of one and done, do we have data yet on how long these vaccines are going to last? Do we need booster shots?
So we have some data, and it's kind of an ongoing data. So right now, I think the most...
Right. We've only had COVID for like a year.
Right.
And
so So we have data that says that our vaccine protection lasts at least 8 months, because that's what we have, 8 months of data. So that doesn't mean it's 8 months and over, but we've followed it for 8 months. It's still here, and they're going to continue following it. And so I think I mentioned earlier that at least the phase three trials, they're following people for 2 years. Mm-hmm. So we'll have a good idea for at least 2 years, and then they may be able to predict what's going to keep happening after that. So it looks like definitely we've got 8 months for certain and very likely much longer. Potential for a booster, we'll have to see. It may depend on how long that protection lasts. So if it looks like we're going to have protection for 5 years, it might be something like tetanus or pertussis, where you just have to get a booster. Maybe you go and you get your tetanus shot and your COVID booster all at the same time. The other thing, though, is we don't really know what's going to happen with the variants. And so I think if we're going to need a booster, the first boosters we're going to see are probably going to be against some of these kind of nasty variants that are starting to form. Mm-hmm. So right now, we don't know. And I do know Moderna is testing some boosters against the different variants that are circulating.
Smart. I thought I saw a study like a week ago, maybe two, that said that something to the effect of, if you've had COVID and you get a vaccine, there's a decent chance you, barring a crazy variant where it's like so different that you would need something new, but you're unlikely to need a booster in that scenario. But if you have just been vaccinated without ever being infected with COVID, you might be more likely to need a booster. I thought it says something like that.
Interesting. I haven't seen that specific study, but I did look at some of the data that shows kind of the immune response after getting COVID and getting vaccinated, or getting just vaccinated alone. And for the people that had COVID and then also got vaccinated, their antibody levels are like sky high. Mm-hmm. They have like six times the amount of antibody as somebody that's been vaccinated. So
I
if you're thinking,
know what those numbers are?
Not off the top of my head. I do know it was a sixfold increase.
Okay.
It was high. But so that makes me think that if I'm thinking about how long is my immune response going to last, it's really, you know, I could kind of follow how many antibodies are left circulating in my blood. And so if you started a really high level of antibodies and they slowly are kind of degrading and you have fewer and fewer, it's going to take a lot longer to get down to none than it is if you start kind of, I don't want to say in the middle, because the vaccine is still a really great antibody response. But if you
Does
have-
it just decay like that? I mean, is there no like memory?
Kind of. I mean, there are definitely memory cells, and most of what we're looking at, the easy way to test is for antibodies, but there are T cells out there. T cells are really important in immune response and protection, and they can be like super long lived, like 20, 30 years. Hmm. So right now, a lot of our predictions on how long this is going to last is just based on antibodies, because they're easy to test. But more research is definitely happening where they're looking at T cell responses and how long those will last too. So we could all be good for a while, which would be fantastic.
I'm participating in this study, and I had to get antibody tested sort of a few months ago. And between then and when I got tested again recently, I had gotten a vaccine. And it was mm-hmm. interesting because they could actually tell if I had had COVID or if I just had the vaccine with the antibody test. But I was surprised. So I got my second shot in February, and in May, my antibodies were still like really high. So that made me happy.
That's awesome.
And you could just go to LabCorp and get an antibody test. If anybody's curious, you could just go do that.
Yep.
Oh, and I wanted to ask one more thing about the numbers about efficacy. So when mm-hmm. you hear the vaccine is 90% effective, 80% effective, what does that actually mean? And in terms of breakthrough infections, and I'm just curious because I've heard a lot of different things, and it's sort of hard to wrap your head around.
Yeah. So I think of it as not so much as a number, like, oh, there's going to be, if a 95% reduction means there's still going to be five cases. That's not quite what it is. It's really a reduction in risk. So if I came into contact with somebody that had COVID for a really long time, and I left there with a 90% chance that I was going to get COVID, just no, unvaccinated, totally normal. And then if you compare that to somebody that was vaccinated, fully vaccinated, same exact scenario, their risk of getting the vaccine, or sorry, getting the virus after the vaccine drops by 95%. So now they might have a 2% chance of getting infected in that same situation. So that efficacy is really decreasing a risk, but there's still all of those other random factors that are at play. So it's hard to turn those into exact numbers, right? It's not going to be four people now get it and the others don't, but that for each contact you come in, or each time you come in contact with the virus, you now have greatly decreased the chance that that contact will turn into an infection.
Got it. So that's why it's important to still wear masks and not cough on anybody.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so actually you could think about it. If you had if you came in contact with 100 different people that had COVID and you had the vaccine, so that's a 95% risk, maybe only five of those instances might lead to an infection.
Yeah, and that sounds different that way, doesn't it?
Yeah, right. I still think of that, like when I go to the grocery store, I was like, there's more than 100 people here.
Right.
I should be careful.
Should still be careful in the grocery store. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, 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 I think we just covered COVID pretty darn well. I learned a lot, so thank you.
Yeah.
Do you have any parting thoughts for anybody who's still sort of on the fence or struggling with certain aspects of this?
Yeah. So I think one thing, we kind of touched on it and didn't go too much into it, is, you know, if somebody had COVID or they're young and healthy, should they really get the vaccine? Right? What's the purpose of it if they're going to be probably okay anyways? And even with kids. And one thing I just kind of really caution people is to think about, again, those long-term effects. We don't know what the long-term effect of infection is. It could be 10 years from now, we'll learn something we didn't know. But the other thing is, I'm really concerned about the variants. Every time somebody gets infected, there's a chance for the virus to mutate. So the more infections means the more risk of variants. So even if we can get a greater percentage of the population vaccinated, that kind of decreases our chance for future variants, which then decreases the chance that we could all need a booster or that we might have a new, really deadly version. Exactly. Something that suddenly becomes really bad for everybody or really bad for children. And so I think probably a fair number of people, and we've seen this in the clinics, that if you're young and healthy, you probably do okay and you don't have any symptoms, but there's still that risk that this may be the source of a new variant. Or unfortunately, there's a fair number of people that aren't able to get vaccinated because of their medical history, or if they're immunocompromised, even if they get vaccinated, they may not have that same level of protection. And so I think if we can limit the overall infections, we can help out protect the people that aren't otherwise able to benefit from the vaccines directly.
Yeah, I just want to summarize those 3 points because I feel like one more time, because I think they're so important. So first, we don't know the long-term effects of getting COVID, even mild COVID. And we know of viruses that cause cancer. Like this is like there's lots of weird things. And this virus is one that is particularly enigmatic. It's going, it's touching so many different body organ systems and so many, there's just been so many different pathologies associated. I personally, to me, that's why it was so terrifying and why like the second I heard about it last January, we started like, I had tons of toilet paper because I started locking this stuff down early. I had all the N95 masks. Sorry guys, but I was like, I was immediately concerned about that. So there's that. Second is there are people who are, you need, it's not just for yourself. There's the people around you. Like you might be fine, but you might kill somebody else. You might kill somebody else's child. Like, like not, it's not just grandmas. Like people are seriously at risk. And then these variants, right? Like the possibility that a SARS-CoV-1 could come back at this infection rate. I mean, that thing was so deadly. And if we mutated closer to something like that, we could be in a situation where we're in lockdown for like years. And if people are still unwilling to get vaccines, we even people that would normally be healthy won't be able to go outside. And I just feel like, to me, the risk benefit of a vaccine that has been shown to be incredibly effective and largely safe compared to all those other like horrific outcomes, it just, to me, it seems not a hard choice. And I do hope that people can take those thoughts and sit with them and consider the big picture.
Right. And you bring up a good point that it is about risk. So there are some people that are probably not at risk. If they're able to work from home and they're getting their groceries delivered, maybe they've got some time to think about this and weigh some options. But there are a lot of people that are working face-to-face jobs. They're constantly coming in contact with people. Right. And so it's really important if you are, or if someone is experiencing risks or put it in a situation where they're at risk, the vaccine can really put a stop to that risk and decrease it significantly.
Right. And we didn't even touch on like what happens to the economy and to livelihoods and to loneliness and stuff when we do have to lock down. And I mean, and then there are so many people that just don't have that luxury to stay home. And I just feel like if you're able to get a vaccine, and especially if you're low risk for any complications, I mean, it just, I think it's important.
Yeah. And I guess that was one point I wanted to make. I forgot to mention it when we were talking about pregnant women earlier. Is we did talk about how the vaccines are generally safe, but I think it's important that pregnant women have a conversation with their doctor before they get vaccinated, because we're talking about sort of general population data, but every pregnancy is different. And there is a lot of considerations that can go into this. And so I think it's important for individuals to have those conversations, because it may be a high risk pregnancy, or there may be concerns of complications just without putting the vaccine in the picture. And so I think, I don't want to say every pregnant woman should get vaccinated, because I think there are going to be risks and considerations there, which then makes it all the more important that the people that they come in contact with should be vaccinated so that they have that protection if they need it.
Yeah, that's a great point. Everybody should talk to your doctor if you're having any questions or concerns. Yeah, that's the person who knows you. If you're concerned about a specific risk, you could do a genetics test if you really want, and learn your risks for blood clots. And there's lots of things you can do. Actually, I do have one more thing I wanted to ask you. Is there any evidence for sort of prophylactic vaccine? What I'm trying to get at is, I took a lot of vitamin D and vitamin C and zinc before going into my vaccines, because I know that vitamin D can bind to the ACE2 receptor, which is what the spike protein binds to. So I'm like, I'm going to bind up all those so it doesn't get any, and I had zero side effects from the vaccine. Like, I didn't even have a sore arm. I'm just curious, but that's totally anecdotal and in my head. Yeah. So I'm wondering if there's any evidence in, not necessarily COVID, but with any vaccines, any way to support our immune systems or support our interactions with the vaccine to make it more effective or make it more less risky or less side effects, things like that.
Yeah, I can't say of any particular drugs, and I've read some of the stuff about vitamin D, and I'm still I've read stuff that it's pro and stuff that says it doesn't really do anything, and so I think that there's still more to be done with a lot of these.
I should qualify that by saying I have 3 mutations for low vitamin D. I take that amount of vitamin D anyway, just to be normal. But that morning I was like, yes,
yeah. I mean, that very much brings to point the idea that everybody is different. And so what works for one may not work for another. But I think if I'm thinking about ways to kind of boost your immune system and give it the best fighting chance, honestly, it's a lot of those good, healthy things, like drink water. Getting a good night's sleep can actually be a huge, huge boost to your immune system. Moderate exercise is a really good boost, but also getting rest when you're having kind of that fight. Because if you're over-exercising, then all of your energy is going to the exercise and not your immune response. And so you make sure you're kind of being active, but then when you get the vaccine, give yourself some time to rest and recover so that you get a good fight going for your immune response. Yeah. Otherwise, just mostly, honestly, for most of us, it's probably just sleep.
Sleep. Don't get hammered the night before.
Yes.
Stuff like that. Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Jennifer. I really learned a lot, and I really appreciate you taking the time to explain it to the rest of us.
Yeah, this was really fun. And it's nice to just have a conversation about it where we get to kind of throw ideas back and forth and discuss, because I think these conversations can often get quite charged and emotional. And so it was nice to kind of just discuss different perspectives and how we might want to consider what's going on with the vaccines and with the virus. So I really enjoyed this. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining today. If you'd like to learn more about Dr. Greer, you can follow her on Twitter at Dr. Greer. That's D-R-G-R-I-E-R. For news and information about infectious disease, immunology, and medicine. As always, if you like the show, I would really appreciate it if you would tell a friend about it. This episode in particular is a fantastic resource for anybody who's curious about COVID vaccines and whether or not they feel comfortable getting one. So please share it far and wide. If you could also leave us a review on Apple or whatever podcast device you use, that would mean a lot to me as well. It'll help us get more great guests like Jennifer and keep this show going strong. So thank you guys, and I'll see you next time.